Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, hello, hello. Welcome back. Instantly picked something up and started fiddling with it, which you can hear on the microphone. That was dumb. Let's start again, shall we? Welcome to episode 7 of Falling Forward with Dan Lesac. I didn't think we would get here. I recorded those first 6 episodes as like a pilot to see if you lot cared, basically. And yeah, you do. So here's another episode. This week's guest is Dan Hare, an artist and quite different to everyone else we've had so far. Most people we've had on have had a literal product to sell. And, you know, I'm not saying that selling your work's important, but Dan's work is very much more traditional art without being made in any sort of traditional way. A creative technologist. He has a massive body of work. You can check that out at danhet.com. And it's really diverse as well. It spans warping people's minds in live music and club settings with visuals, but all the way through to work creating poetry in cities and installations and just... I'm jealous, basically, is what I'm saying. I'm jealous. But this is very much a podcast of the two halves as well, which kind of leads me to the first time I've ever really done a trigger warning. But there's a few things you need to know about the podcast before we start. First things first, I swear so much in this podcast. I noticed it when I was going through just editing out all the burps and all the cake eating. We ate a lot of cake. But yeah, I swear, like, I think, especially in the second half where we're talking about more emotional topics, my emotions come through. And, you know, that's fine. But just if you're at work, I do even use the C word once. So you should be aware of that. It's definitely not a ghoulish conversation. It's a conversation that leads to some really big ideas about not only creativity, but what it is to be a human in the social media age, to have to live through painful life events whilst not being able to hide from the world. And I'm genuinely grateful that Dan was willing to share all that with me as well. So yeah, that's the trigger warning. I've never done one before, so is it a trigger warning or a content warning? I don't know. Also, I need to plug something. Me and Dan talk about it at the end of the podcast, but because of I talk over him about 8 times, it's not a very clear plug. But he's currently working on... I'm getting my phone out so I can get his description. He's currently working on a project called Closed Hands, and it's he'd describe it as a large-scale interactive fiction project that looks unflinchingly at radicalization and extremism. So there, I can read. You don't know how many takes that took. Unflinchingly, I struggled with many times. And you can find out more information about that at passenger-games.com or just Google it. It definitely sounds like a really interesting project, and you'll find out more about his other work in the podcast, but it's definitely an evolution on that. And before we get started, I have to do the horrible plugging. Music, again, this week is by me. Last week's music was actually unreleased stuff, which the Patreons should be receiving in the next few days. But I use my own music, so I'm not infringing on somebody else's, anyone else's copyright. Also, I fund this podcast entirely through Patreon. Obviously, there's travel and all that stuff. So if you're enjoying it enough, if you're finding it insightful, if you're learning anything, if you feel sorry for me, if you feel pity in your soul for me, patreon.com/DanLasak is where you go to drop me a dollary do and support the cast. Although there is basically nothing to feel sorry for me for, you know, if I can fake some pity out of you, that'd be cool. I want to get the good pizzas. Get to the point, Dan. Anyway, so here it is, the episode. This is me and Dan Hett chatting away up in his studio in Stockport. Enjoy.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
It was cool. It was exciting. Oh,
amazing.
So, who are you?
Oh, man, who are
Dan
I?
Dan Hett. I've got that. Oh, I wrote father next to your name.
Yes, just in case that is my entire definition as a person now.
There we go. Dan Hett.
Father plus other.
Done.
I answer this question so many times, and it's different every day, so it depends. In terms of like my gig and my creative thing, father of two. So if I kill someone, I'll be father of two in the newspapers.
Yeah.
You're always father of two.
Dan Hett, father of two.
And then in creative terms, I guess I am somewhere between digital artist and experimental games designer and a bunch of other stuff. Mm. So I'm generally a creative digital.
You had a what, creative technologist?
Yeah,
I've seen you.
So yeah. I've had official proper jobs, 9-to-5 jobs, where I've been a technologist or a research technologist or a interactive dev, that kind of thing. So it's generally creative end.
You said that in like a talk or like blab or whatever, and it instantly I stopped listening to you because I started thinking about creative accountants, and I was like. Is a creative accountant someone who just uses lots of colours in Excel spreadsheets?
Like a creative accountant sounds to me more like someone working for the mafia who like sort of like true, just creatively is it.
I just like the idea. Just very flamboyant Excel spreadsheets.
Yeah, I'm just really, really good at Microsoft Word at this point. So, I'm a software engineer underneath, and so I didn't study software at all. And I studied just up the road. I can almost see where I studied from here as well. Never left at Stockport. And I did a degree in design and visual arts. And I thought I was going to be an illustrator or a graphic designer. I had it in my head. And then at no point did I realise I just didn't have the skills to do it. I was terrible. So I was doing what was then called multimedia, which is lots of animation and video and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And fell into programming completely by accident during that course. And I tell this story constantly, but it's completely true. I had to make an animation of this guy waving, but I only wanted him to do it three times and then stop. and I had to learn just enough code to go, okay,
to do that.
Once it's done it three times, don't do it anymore. And literally that one thing was a kind of, I can make stuff, do stuff now. And it like took a little while, but I kind of built up and up and up. And then ended up, unexpectedly, my final project ended up being a really, really sort of software-y thing, where I was making computer interfaces for blind users using sound tones and things, sort of mapping kind of spectrums of kind of tones to space and stuff. So I kind of became a computer programmer literally by accident. I just said, not by accident, but I kind of didn't expect it at all. And then went into kind of... I've always been on the creative side, so I went into kind of...
Did you gravitate towards code and shenanigans because it gave you a way of creating the stuff that was in your head? Like, you say you're a bad graphic designer, but you're obviously visually... You have visual acuity, so...
Yeah.
it... Like, because that's why I made digital music for years, is because I, rubbish musician.
Yeah.
And it gave me a vehicle. I was like, oh, hang on, that thing in my brain, I can get it out finally.
It's exactly that. It was just another vehicle, a much better vehicle for me to take what was in my brain and get it out in a form that actually reflected what I wanted to make. But yeah, I mean, the code thing is, it's just a much more direct way for me to go, okay, I have this thing in my head, I want to get it out. And programming... it's just been this natural way for me to express stuff really well. Sometimes in a way where I go, I want this to look exactly like this, and I can pop it out. And increasingly, certainly over the last sort of 4 or 5 years, the code that I write is intentionally done so I don't know what the results are going to be. Particularly, I do a lot of stuff on stage now, for example, doing live visuals for gigs and festivals and things. So I'm sort of using the same skills, but I'm now increasingly interested in unpredictability, which is kind of the enemy of what most software engineers want.
To explain for the audience, so you do stuff under the name Rituals as a visual artist, and the Algoraves.
Yes.
So algorithmic, Algorave. Both music creation and...
Yes.
You're doing the visuals.
Yeah. So I do make sound, but I would never unleash it on poor, unsuspecting audiences. I'm much more happy making things for eyeballs.
But so you're creating like visuals live, but not in... So most people will have seen visuals, but usually that's video mixing.
Yeah.
That's video DJ.
A bit of VJing. It's a very 90s thing on paper, I think, VJing.
It is. Weirdly, like people like DJ Yoda do it now.
Yoda's a different case, though. Like, that is next level. But actually, it's a really good comparison. So the stuff that Yoda does and similar artists, there's a complete sort of symbiosis between the music and the... I mean, he's literally scratching video. It's sort of mixed. Yeah. It's like exactly...
Using Serato as a...
Yeah.
Although he's... No, don't get technical, Dan. Move on.
I couldn't tell you how, but having seen it like a few times. In fact, he played after us at Blue Dot Festival a couple of years back. So I think he might have...
Is that Jodrell Bank?
Yes, yeah.
Oh, nice.
So what he does is a really good example, and it's similar to Algorave in the sense that the music and visuals are designed to work together. Because I listen to a lot of electronic music, I go to a lot of raves and gigs and things, and quite often the visuals are just sort of put something up because it's flashy or whatever. But there's not that kind of link.
Yeah.
And then the Algorave thing is, so if the listeners who don't know what it is, it's kind of hard to explain. I tried explaining it to my dad and he didn't get it. Is sort of an electronic music movement where everything is created completely live and improvised with code, a small amount of code that tends to evolve over time rather than lots and lots. You see it on the Matrix with like screens and screens and screens of code. It's like the opposite of that. It's like little tiny sort of almost phrases and paragraphs that generate loops and cycles and beats and things. And then the visuals kind of sort of are very, very closely linked in the sense that I'm reacting to what the person is improvising with. So I don't go into any of these gigs knowing what I'm going to be doing. I don't know what the tone of the music is going to be. It might be an insane drum and bass set. It might be I've done visuals for like experimental drone sessions for like 2 hours and whatever and everything in between. Which is kind of the draw for me, is I like the idea of like your entire career as particularly in software terms tends to be very planned out. So before I write a line of code, there'll be meetings and sketches and designs and all this other stuff. Whereas this is much more about saying, okay, you've got this palette of stuff you can use creatively. You have no idea what you're going to be asked to do until you're doing it, and it's usually a few hundred drunk partying people doing it as well. So it's a terrifying thing to do, but it's creatively is exactly the kind of challenge that I gravitate towards.
It's no different to jazz or something like that. Like, it's a group of people who are communicating through the notes that they're playing. So much creativity that is designed to be watched as it happens.
It's a performance in the very sort of literal sense, isn't it?
Yeah. So much of that, though, relies on some sort of synergy in people's ability to improvise. I don't know, I've always found it pretty interesting to watch. The Battlers, a band who used to improvise everything, the Bays, I think they were called, and to see them live it was really cool. Well, once it was. The next time, I don't know.
I was going to say.
Yeah, I think one of them was a bit ill.
But that's part of the fun, though. I think, like, what I mean, even just as a punter, going to performances, what I don't want from a band is to get this perfect rendition of what I've heard on the record. What I want is a band to play, right? And I think the imperfection is kind of what I want out of most things, really. It's what proves to you that it's happening, and that's kind of why.
Yeah, you like, from the music point of view, your album's not finished until you've played it live.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the only album that will ever be finished is your first one, because that's the one that happens after. You know, me and Pip didn't start till I was 27, 28, so that album had been written over 10 years and performed and all that. Whereas the second album, like, it's dog shit compared to what it became once we played it live.
hundreds of times. Get under the skin of it in a live context. Yeah,
the song everyone knows us for is garbage compared to where it was 10 years later, which was literally 10 years after. The testing things to an audience, that feedback helps so much. Which must be nice for someone who would usually be creating things in isolation. You know?
Yeah. So, I mean, I've always had in my head this image of, if you're writing software in any context, I always had this image in my head of the, you know, this lone wolf kind of at a computer, headphones on, going which admittedly I was doing before you arrived for about six hours. But generally, I actually think the biggest skill in software or any kind of, I think most creative stuff that I'm involved in is communication, and most of the stuff that I'm most proud of has been the stuff that's involved others. And I think that when you're writing code, I just think, like, without this ecosystem of other people around you and communication and helping each other out, I think you're never going to get it. And I'm nothing without talking to people constantly. And I think that's kind of always been true of the stuff that I do. I think you can't do this stuff on your own, and you can't learn it on your own. Or you get up to a certain point, but then as soon as you trip and get stuck, because it's quite technical, you can't. It's not the kind of thing you can sort of jimmy yourself out of. You always need other people. So it's kind of it's almost the opposite of what people expect, really. There's definitely sort of very, very little isolation in my sort of work anyway. I mean, if you look at my portfolio, the really big, exciting stuff is always with other people, and almost always those other people are not programmers. So I prefer working with dancers or theatre producers or poets or whatever else.
You did one called Paradox Paradox, which is like you.
Oh,
and,
man, yeah.
It's like, but it's you and what, eight people?
Yeah.
Or you're one of eight.
Yeah. Man.
But you were given a space for...
Because we were given the run of Home in Manchester, which is a massive gallery. It's open
for five
a few years
days.
So it was five full days, and it was a completely free experimentation space, basically. So there were sort of spoken word artists, painters, performers.
Spoken
and I was,
word artists?
It was just the whole thing.
It was
great. It ended up... It was great, actually. So it was like, and we're sort of all still in touch. And don't think anyone's worked together since. We need to never hang out. But as a thing, being the only...
I don't think
anyone,
any of us have spoken to each other ever again.
we're pals, but I mean, like, as an experience, like, that was kind of one of the kind of tipping points for me. At that point, when I did it and did well and kind of expressed myself weirdly with a load of other people,
because
at that point I sort of almost began to allow myself to be called an artist in some contexts. I mean, it was 5 days in this massive gallery space. The public could come in, but we could do anything we wanted in the space.
So the public could come in and just see the process.
Yeah. And we were all dressed in white. We had paint and light and everything else, and we just annihilated the joint constantly, and then rebuilt it and repainted it and annihilated it again. And we were playing with the audience and trying to make paths through the gallery, and we made works that would then disappear within a few hours. then we collaborate and then we break each other's stuff, and it was, and we started to get covered in paint and we were all kind of exhausted and sweaty, and it, yeah, it was kind of hard to describe, but the whole thing was just like this, and it had like all these ebbs and flows to it, and it got really, really weird after a few days. We turned all the lights off on the second day and the lights just stayed off for the whole thing, and it got really intense, and we were experimenting with light and form and cameras and paint and all sorts. So like proving that I could do that, and you know, although I'm a tech guy under the hood, putting myself in a context that is completely improvisational was quite a, quite a weird thing.
This thing, like if you're a painter and you're improvising, you can make it happen instantly. That's how long does it take to dip your paint in some paint and put that brush on something? But like you obviously have already been gravitating towards that, trying to make a computer process instantaneous, but how did you find that challenge? Did it take you time to find your space within that group?
Kind of, yeah. I mean, so what I did was I brought a bunch of sort of stuff with me that I knew I could work with really
crack
quickly.
And
so
heroin,
yeah, just basically meth the whole time.
The eyes that I stayed alive.
If I could have done with it, it was ridiculous. But I had like a lot of bits of live code, for example. So I had stuff ready that would generate patterns based on noise input or textures. Uh-huh. And I had a load of I do a little bit of video mixing occasionally. So I had like a lot of video textures and things, and we were mapping onto stuff and kind of experimenting. So it was all quite simple.
Yeah.
But again, my stuff tends to be fairly simple anyway. But the idea that, oh, we'd build this massive structure, or that someone would build some massive structure, and then I'd be able to quickly rig up a projector and light it up and experiment with it. And then they'd sort of open it, and then we'd mess around. And it was being able to respond really, really quickly. I think actually a lot of the stuff you do with a computer doesn't necessarily have to take hours or days. You can go, okay, just give me 5 minutes and I'll put something exciting on this thing and we can mess with it.
Yeah.
But I use a lot of hardware controllers and things just so I can not be looking at the screen and I can be looking at the thing that I'm doing and messing with stuff without looking at it. So I tend to kind of, I like using things like iPads so I can go into the crowd and experiment with stuff and see it from where the audience is. For
example, this kind of thing. The touch thing.
Oh, Touch OSC.
Oh, Touch OSC, but I'm actually thinking of something else.
Okay.
Tim Exile, electronic musician, is developing an app at the moment called Endless, which is a looper, basically.
Okay.
So, but it's got synth in there, drums in there, beat choppery stuff and all that.
Is that a technical term?
Beat chopper.
Beat choppery stuff.
Beat repeat, I think some people. But I've never used touch, really. I've always been either keys or knobs. Mm-hmm. It's really odd, like so instantaneous. And the way they've built that around a mobile phone, it's really, it did something strange. It kept making me think about how easy it must be for children to understand phones.
Yes, I can absolutely confirm that.
Like, because it just made me remember. Like,
it's a problem, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah. But you know what I mean? It's like we all, as kids, touched everything. Yeah. And now you get instant feedback. Like if you've got a modern phone, it'll even give a little bit of haptic feedback
little
to let you know. And I'm just like, I'm wondering how touch is so natural, yet does that mean our kids are going to be elite hackers?
You know? I'm really worried about this, actually. So I was a lot more computer literate than my parents and was able to get around anything they put in place in terms of blocking stuff. But I'm very worried that my kids are going to overrule
me. How old are your kids?
At the moment, 6 and 4.
Okay, so you don't have to worry about the porn ban yet.
Well...
literally, I think... Like, there's modern 10-year-olds who are going to be able to get around that porn ban.
I'm very worried.
To be fair, you can just Google your way around the porn ban when it comes in.
But, I mean, the touch thing is really interesting, though. So, like, Ed, my youngest, he's not even 4, and he touches every television to him is a touch screen. And he's got that swipe thing, it's like the default, and he touches around until stuff happens. And it's normally me pressing the remote, but his first experimental kind of
You're lying to him.
I'm not quite lying, but it just happens at the same time. But yeah, it's just really, really interesting. It's just the default interaction method now is to just press your finger on it and swipe and prod around and stuff. So, but yeah, I think I definitely know my stuff, but I'm genuinely worried. I think like every generation, you think you know,
oh god,
and then the thing that is you need to know in 10 years is going to be not something you know, and then your children are going to be smarter.
Yeah, we are like constantly ramping up, like in development, in the knowledge you require to get through the day as such. You know. But at the same time, these systems are so naturalistic that, yeah, my mum can cope with a touchscreen phone. Mm-hmm. You know, she's very intimidated at first, but she's far more comfortable with a tablet. I got her like a... She wanted a tablet, but she won't accept gifts, so I got her like a crappy Amazon Fire for like 60 quid or something. And she uses that far more than the computer they've had sat in the corner for...
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure they've had that computer since I was 18. I think it's a 286 and it hand crank.
But I mean, as long as it's got a browser on it, then you know. I mean, my in-laws, they have a tablet now, but they were Linux users for years and didn't know what Linux was because I rescued their old laptop, stuck a Linux distribution on it, because all they wanted was a browser, and like it didn't matter what was underneath. And actually, so I think they're probably the most inexperienced Linux users ever, but it didn't matter because they could click a thing and it put internet on.
Yeah,
that was enough. But they're now on, everyone's on tablets and kind of. Yeah, I mean, even like really, I saw a video the other day of a kid playing Fortnite against some guy with a mouse and a keyboard, and he had like both his hands hovering. He was playing on a tablet, both his hands hovering over it, making the tiniest little motions with almost all of his fingers, like he was touch typing, and he was kind of selecting items and also moving the view and controlling his characters, but his hands were like barely moving, and it was just like a level of interaction that I just never thought possible and could never achieve. Physically or mentally.
Gaming is weird anyway because it drives so much. I think it does a lot to teach us art, like aesthetics, and you know I know cinema's done it for years and all that, but I think you spend so much time in games that you can't avoid it. You can't help but see the creative process that goes in there. I don't know. Although there's games that are just big anime titties as well. Not my bag.
Takes all sorts.
There's
a game for everybody, especially creepy weirdos.
To create interactive pornography. You said in one of the... I watched a few talks, I read a few articles. Mm-hmm. You can't draw, which you've brought up already.
I'm not sure I can't draw.
No, that's what you said. I've written it here. It says can't draw.
Shit graphic designer. Okay, that's true.
I've written average programmer, but you actually say okay programmer.
That's true. So, and I say it quite a lot. So I get a lot of questions from people going, oh man, can you teach me how to be a rock star programmer? And actually, I'm definitely not an incredible programmer and have spent my entire life working with programmers who are vastly superior to me. And what I always say to these people is kind of, again, I don't describe myself as a good programmer, but I am a good problem solver, and I'm an ideas guy. I'm kind of, so although programming tends to be the primary way through which I do stuff, I got to a certain level of skill where I went, great, I can do this stuff now, I can get ideas out of my brain. But then from there, there's a massive extra amount of skill that you could do. If you know, if you want to become really specialized at computer graphics or AI or you know, whatever your specialism within computer science is, that is what I would describe as an excellent programmer. Whereas I'm more like somebody who harnesses programming to do stuff. But I would never describe myself nowadays as a software engineer because really that's not the primary point of what I do. What I am is a digital artist.
So a software tickler?
Yeah, I'm just a noodler.
Noodler.
I'm a software botherer at best. But I just think, I mean, although I've made massive, complicated things, I can write excellent code. I just don't want to anymore because doing that there's a lot of extra stuff you have to do. So, you know, I was at the BBC for years and I worked on a game for four-year-olds called Storytime.
Was that the BAFTA award winner?
It actually wasn't, but I worked on a different project that won the BAFTA, and then Storytime was the runner-up as well.
Oh, same year?
In the same category.
So you were just
Well,
double.
Well, I still didn't go to the party.
You were double bagging the BAFTAs.
I only saw the trophy once, and then the BBC presumably threw it into
their
pile.
Covered, yeah.
But yeah, so like that kind of thing.
What's the fucking deal with only getting one?
It's one trophy, really heavy as well.
Me and Pitt won, there's the Association of Independent Music, and we won like Best Video.
Mm-hmm.
And there's me and Pitt, that's two people, and the guy who directed the video, Tom.
Did you get one each?
One plastic trophy.
Unbelievable.
And it wasn't like a BAFTA, which is like metal and like craft.
Like you could kill an intruder with a BAFTA. I mean,
this was hefty. This wasn't even 3D printed. This was just cut out of thick, clear plastic. Right, a clear acrylic.
It's not about the materials. It's about what it represents, right?
Oh, we can't... Yeah, we just do one. But you can buy a blank one. Wait, what? So I can buy... Without my name on it. Awesome.
You can't buy the meaning, though, right?
Yeah.
So that kind of project was a year-long... Super kind of, it was at the top end of my skill in terms of complexity and everything else.
It's funny because you bring up in talks, you bring up clips of story time,
mm-hmm.
and people laugh, and I still can't work out why.
It's because I give talks to friggin' hipsters, actually the fact that it's all
cute dog puppet there and stuff. And
I think it's because a lot of particularly like software people are a nightmare as well. So they're all kind of engineers, and then I go, I'm more happy that this is squidgy and colourful and silly. Mm. So it's that kind of thing. I can do it, but I think in doing that, it's a very time consuming thing. It takes a long, there's meetings and hundreds of people involved, and it's a very difficult thing to do. Whereas I'm much more interested in going, okay, I can take all of the skill that I would put into that kind of project and do something super quick and laser focused and do 1,000 of those in the same time kind of thing. And it's sort of absolutely wouldn't want to shit on anyone who does amazing software stuff, and we need those people. I'm not the guy anymore, and I just, as soon as I sort of made the mental leap to start just having a bit more fun with the stuff, I couldn't go back now. just couldn't do it. Even as a 9-to-5, I don't think I could. If someone said, I'm going to pay you to do a 6-month software project, even if the money was good, I don't think I've got it in me nowadays.
Yeah.
I really don't. So
you've brought up the BBC. You worked for the BBC, 3-4 years?
Four and a half years, something like that.
So fair chunk of that with CBBS, mm-hmm. doing
yep. kid stuff,
interactive shenanigans, squidgy for them.
Yeah, squidgy kid stuff.
And then the last chunk was with R&D.
Yes, yeah.
Which is crazy. You don't even think that the BBC would have. It's not that you don't think they would have one. It just never crosses your mind that they have an R&D department.
Well, the R&D department has been part of the BEEB. So the I think the R&D department are the only ones that are specifically named in the Royal Charter from the 30s or wherever it was. I don't know. I've not revised. They do tons of stuff. So that things like Codex and really hardcore important stuff.
Yeah.
Is often from R&D. When I was there, it was sort of working on slightly more... unimportant, arguably, projects. But they do such a wide range of stuff. And I kind of arguably, and again, I say this in my talks, is it was really a dream gig doing cutting edge, weird stuff with computers. And I still quit.
About in art galleries.
Because I think it's because I'd sort of been moonlighting doing bits and bobs. Mm. I've been doing freelance gigs on the side for 10 years. And then I got to a point, I've been freelance fully, full time, for a bit over two years. And R&D, I was sort of full time, really having loads of fun. But then my sort of war story for why is that it used to take me ages to get there. And I'd sit at a computer for 8 hours some days, say hello to my colleagues, and then leave again. And then it used to, I missed my kids. It was about 4 days in a row where I didn't see my son in the morning because I left early.
Yeah.
And I got back really late. And he asked where I'd gone on holiday. and literally, I just went, I'm not getting this time back. This is ridiculous.
Yeah,
then just handed my notice in. Went freelance just mostly for the flexibility.
You're not getting this time back either. This time right now,
I'm going to send you an invoice.
I'm keeping this.
It was
just bounce invoices back and forth.
With a sorry, this took a while. I kind of been thinking about it for years, but never really had that kind of. Nothing ever pushed me off the cliff. It's quite a scary thing. Suddenly becoming self-employed is fucking terrifying. But I just thought, initially it was kind of I'd rather be sat having breakfast with my kids and taking them to school instead of sitting in a crowded train in some guy's armpit for an hour and a half every day. And that was great, and that totally don't regret it. But then over the last couple of years, I've kind of hit my stride and gone, actually, I can do this. I'm now doing a ton of stuff that there's no way I could say yes to residencies. You know, I went to Pakistan on a residency for a week and did like weeks and weeks of prep in the run-up.
So that was Lahore, like that. Wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
I've done research. I'm getting better at this.
Yeah, I mean, so I kind of... So the context for this was that I was asked to go to Lahore with the guys from MadLab, this amazing creative kind of group, I guess, that used to be a place and now they're more of an entity and they're great. So we went out there with the British Council, and the project that I started was sort of an exploration into Islamic geometry. So you see it in architecture and textiles and everything. And that's kind of a really good example of me putting myself in a position where I have to do something new. And it was kind of like something I found interesting. I had no knowledge of it whatsoever and went, great, this is what I want to do. I want to use my code and my skills and whatever to go, okay, well, can I explore this and kind of add to it or whatever.
But the thing that sort of fascinates me about it is it relates to creativity in that our limitations, we're always being limited. We've either got limited time or limited
money
or even limited ability in my case. but those limitations are things that you learn to either embrace or overcome. And obviously, that's almost for an Islamic artist. That's the ultimate limitation there. Oh, you can't draw God, by the way. Can't draw God. Wait, what? Yeah, yeah.
You're going to have to do something else. Yeah. Quick.
But you know, we pretty much invented math, right? You can use that, although don't actually use the numbers because they're bad as well now. They were good for a while, but then we decided they were bad. We made up the word algorithm. But don't use the numbers.
I feel like there was probably more to the conversation, but that is my
that's
reading
like
of it.
That's like a 300-year thing
compressed into
condensed. But it's fascinating to me that, like, okay, so clearly, like, 800 AD, that part of the world being like the melting pot of mathematics and big thought, and then becoming a little more restrained by new religious doctrine. Obviously, the religion had been around a long time, but it became a lot more restrictive. Yet, the creativity had to come out, and the mathematics had to come out.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Like, you go into an older mosque, and it's a beautiful... It's made by a computer, in a sense, but obviously not.
Well, I mean, the reason I gravitated towards it was that I didn't touch a computer for weeks and weeks and weeks during the activity. So the first kind of part for me, I mean, I will not profess to be anything but a dabbler still, just in terms of just learning the very, very core concepts. So I felt it was really important to work by hand, to go, okay, well, how do I start to draw these forms? Because they tend to be... So the idea is...
You weren't, like, pulling out a spirograph.
To be honest, a few people made spirograph jokes, and it was kind of like, it's so much better than that. Come on, man.
So much more.
But, I mean, the idea that with a mark-making tool and a straight edge, and, well, I mean, a compass, or, like, you know, if you were doing it big sculpturally, it would just be a piece of rope. And you can construct all of those forms from those tools without looking at numbers or anything else. It's all about kind of how circles and shapes and everything else interlinks. And I spent a few weeks doing it just by hand on paper, and I think my wife thought I'd gone mental. My entire house started to fill up with pieces of paper and books and things. And that part is the sweet spot for me of this is a new thing to you. You know nothing about it. Wade in.
Yeah,
try
yeah.
it. Give it a whirl. And then while I was doing it, I sort of like got better and better at sort of constructing more and more complicated forms. And it was like this light goes on in your head where you go, I've made this from nothing but a bit of knowledge. And it's just like a pure expression of geometry. And it makes these beautiful things that just emerge from almost nothing. And it's that kind of simplicity of that I don't need a vast array of tools. I just need to know how to tickle out this kind of how to tease out the kind of the form within. It's all there. You just need to know how to kind of extract it.
Yeah,
and everything makes sense. And it's sort of you can get I could talk about it forever. It's a fantastic thing. But what was cool about it was once I'd gotten to a certain point of just understanding the basics, it was very, very, you know, people dedicate their entire lives to this field of study. I then started to go into the computer to go, okay, well, can I make the computer kind of follow my process? So I ended up producing this kind of continually updating, almost like live animation, that would draw the circles in pencil and delicate kind of forms first, and then put in the patterns over the top, just to demonstrate the process. And then all we did was we took that and just beamed it massive in the middle of Lahore on the side of a building and kind of just caused a bit of trouble. But I mean, all it ended up being was like a digital expression of the stuff that I'd learned. And that sometimes is enough. And my initial ideas for it were really complicated, saying, oh, well, can we hook up a Kinect so people could wave their arms and draw pictures and all this other shit? And the more, particularly when I got out there, and I was kind of like sat cross-legged on the floor of this hotel room, kind of racing to get it all finished. And then I sort of like realized, actually, the thing in and of itself is appealing and interesting enough. And I was stood there kind of for 3 nights while it ran, speaking to people just to say, what this, they were like, what is this? Is it a video? And I was like, no, no, it's a computer that's doing this thing. And it was enough to just say that, to say, I've just made this thing that expresses me learning this and and just demonstrates how much, you know, drawing a like a hexagon with a small pattern on it, there's actually quite a lot of geometry underneath. The guidelines are then disappear and the final pattern is there. And all it does is it shows that construction and then gets rid of the construction and shows you the final thing. And it just, doing one, I think just as a broad thing, doing one thing and doing it really, really well, for me, is worth way more than overcooking something and having a million things, but it being a bit impenetrable. You know, if I'd done something really complicated where I need to tell people how to use it, you know, if I'd set a Kinect up or a camera and said, oh, you need to do this, and until you do it, you won't get it. Whereas this is, it's just an appealing thing in and of itself and doesn't need any more framing.
It's quite interesting because I've only seen stills of that, so I've not seen that the computer was actually showing the process as well. You seem more interested in how it got made rather than the final product.
Stuff like that, where I basically try and recreate images by giving computers very simple instructions and then figuring out if it's gotten closer or not. You're sort of brute forcing into something. But actually, I quite like that. You know, there are a million really clever ways you could do it. But actually, I prefer the idea of going, okay, I'm going to write this very simple thing and just leave it running, let it happen. I have no idea if it's going to work, but it's going to be interesting finding out, right?
Yeah.
And that's it, that's sort of pervades all my stuff now. Like it's exactly the same as what I do on stage. When I go, okay, that, I'm going to set that number, I'm going to set that shape, I'm going to pick some colours, I have no idea what it's going to turn out like. I've got a pretty rough idea of a direction, but I don't want to know what it's... I want to see it unfold in front of me, and that's kind of... That's the kicker for me.
But is that part of the attraction with, in a sense, writing bad code? That as you don't...
Loaded term, that.
You know what I mean. Like, writing... so that you don't quite know
it's depends on your metric of good and bad, I suppose. But I think writing code where your intention is to not know what's going to happen, particularly when you're doing it at scale in a nightclub in front of hundreds of people, is, if that's the goal, then simple weird code is definitely a good thing, right? But I just think, like, I prefer that over, you know, if I'm working with a team of 5 or 6 other people on a £100,000 project or whatever.
Yeah,
I don't want to. I want to know what's going to happen when I press the button.
Yeah, it just makes.
But where's the fun in that?
Yeah.
So I'm really, really interested in people interrogating forms like that. Even though, you know, that it's more of a just a new way of looking at things rather than going, oh, I'm going to pour 7 years of monstrous coding into something. I like the idea that I can just take a different approach to stuff.
Yeah.
Without tripping over the code. I just prefer different approaches versus monstrous levels of technology. Makes sense. I think that sounds like a cop out for wanting to not write loads of code, which it kind of is.
Well, but that's fine. Like, you can, like, this is what I want to do, especially as a creative. Like, I want to create this. This is the way that's going to most entertain me, or easiest way for me to create this.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong in that. And it's something that happens in all creative industries. We start getting into this idea that, whoa, I want to make this kind of music, so I need all this equipment, I need to spend this money.
The kit thing, man, it is endemic. Like, there's nothing worse, and I do this, I'm really bad for this. I think there's always, and I don't think it's even just a creative thing, it's just a people thing, the notion that if you buy the latest thing, you will become excellent at the thing.
Oh, God, yeah.
Like, you know, if the midlife crisis guy buys a £4,000 road bike or guitar, or whatever. And I've done it. I bought an expensive MIDI controller thinking, man, my synths are going to go off now.
What did you get?
Oh God, well, I don't know, but I got rid of it in favour of a cheap APC mini.
Good.
Because it goes in my bag easier. Mm. But like, I'm really bad for it in terms of saying, right, well, if I download the latest version of the software, then my stuff must be intrinsically better. It's going to come out better. Mm. But ultimately, like, it's completely not true. And I know I'm doing it as well. So now, I consciously make an effort to not depend on the latest cutting edge stuff. And I prefer going, okay, well, I can just make most stuff in JavaScript and a bit of this and a bit of that. And it just becomes less sort of tool-y, I guess. Mm. And this is why I'm put off by things like a lot of really hardcore VR stuff. And there's so many people doing amazing stuff in it. But I never want to make work that is really dependent on a particular kind of gadget or a particular kind of thing. I like making stuff that can just exist anywhere, in as many places as possible.
One of the many algorithmic music creation things, is that Sonic Pi one?
Yes, yeah.
Will run on a Raspberry Pi, but will also, it will pretty much run on...
Run on my toaster, if you ask nicely.
Yeah.
But that's the appeal for me, is it democratizes it. You can just... Any computer will run it, and it becomes about you and not about your stuff and how much you've spent.
I've been talking, like, a kid came at me, he did kind of come at me on Twitter.
All up in your face.
But about microphones, weirdly. He was like, well, I can't, you know, I'm too poor to make music. You know, because I was doing that sort of vaguely inspirational thing. But, like, first of all, he's tweeting me from my phone, so he owns a microphone, and... Well, if you've... For free, there are plenty of free apps that you can start making beats with.
Completely.
If you've got 40 quid, there's a fully featured DAW made by Korg that runs on iPhone and iPad.
Yep.
And you've got... So it's like, well, no, you don't get into this thing where you need a £3,000 Neumann mic.
You're still going to have to learn to use it. You know, you're still going to have to make the content and make the thing.
Yeah, like...
And I think you also get that diminishing returns thing, right? You know, it's stuff like... like things like even Photoshop or whatever, shit hasn't changed in 10 years, and it really hasn't. Like, and I just software is exactly the same. People just fixate on having the latest thing, and it ultimately is not. And you can make, I make my games nowadays in, so I make a lot of video games, and I make them in Twine, which is for making stories, Pico 8, because it's easy and I can just do it and it runs everywhere. And I think like the more experienced I get and the older I get, the less interested I am in making stuff that is just has so many dependencies on having bleeding edge stuff or really hardcore requirements and all that stuff. I don't know, I just puts me off a little bit.
You bring up Twine, obviously. One of the games you made in Twine was See You Later, which deals with the aftermath of the Manchester bombing and your brother's death. Can you feel my like sudden nervousness?
Cut it with
there?
A knife, can't
just
you?
Like, straight in.
It's totally fine.
Straight in.
At this point, it's absolutely fine to talk about it. I have a lot of people going, am I okay to talk about this?
Yeah, yeah.
Stand on stages and talk about it is completely cool thing. Not cool thing to talk about, but it's fine.
But like, so for people who don't know, Twine is a HTML, i.e. the browser internet engine for creating games.
It was specifically interactive fiction.
Obviously, the Gamergate legend Zoe Quinn made her Depression Quest in there. I'm not a Gamergater. I like Depression Quest, and I'm fine with women existing. Just for clarity there. But
put that on your business card.
Obviously, See You Later is a deeply emotional thing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like, you do crack jokes in there, which is impressive.
That pervaded the whole thing. And yeah. Obviously, it was a fucking horrendous experience. I'm sorry, I should swear.
You can swear. It was horrendous. The C word yet. I'm saving that for in case we bring up Tommy.
I don't want to be the first. The humour thing kind of pervaded the entire thing anyway. And I think that's quite common, this sort of black humour that you just kind of sometimes fall back on.
Like, I suppose because you're not, even though you're talking about what is happening in the moment, you're still talking about your brother, and you clearly, like, in, from that, I can infer that you two had a fucking fun relationship.
Yeah, that's where it's from, isn't it?
Yeah.
So there were jokes in the game, and, you know, I made probably the most horrific joke I've ever made and ever will make on Twitter about a day after we'd found out he'd been killed, and I said something about him making this bold social media move, but it worked because he'd got on Mariah Carey's Instagram or something, and I was like, I was pretty dubious about this social media strategy, but it worked, and it was awful. I think he'd be impressed that it was a joke so brutal that Marina Hyde wrote a Guardian article about it, about the joke. I think there's a place.
But he would laugh
for it. He'd cackle like a fucking pirate, without a doubt.
And so
that kind of thing, like, the game was a knee jerk thing that I made, and it's unedited, and it's got typos, mm-hmm. and it's got a couple of dead ends, and I don't want to touch it. I don't want to ever touch it now. And the jokes that are in there and the kind of weirdness are in there completely reflected my actual thoughts. And the joke, you know, we were kind of like, when people were looking for him, we were joking about, you know, he's going to be passed out on someone's couch like a dick and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And it's just part of how people deal with stuff sometimes. I think it's a particularly British thing as well. Like, British are very, you know, my stepdad is a GP, and he's really well qualified. He's seen it all. And he's a great person. But a really, really experienced medical professional, and he's seen it all. Absolutely been right through the machine. And he's got the weirdest, blackest sense of humour. And I think it's the same thing. It's this coping kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, yes, the game is... it's a short, branching narrative game that doesn't specifically mention any names or locations, but if you know me, you will know it's talking about my experience. Yeah. But if you didn't know me, you would still get a thing out of it. And what it basically does is, I kind of almost wrote it by accident. So I've always written. I just constantly journal and chronicle and whatever. Mm. And at the time, I'd written down a lot of the stuff that I'd... Because the experience was so intense, both in terms of losing him and the fact that it was so high profile, and just a million things happened in a few days.
There's a bit in the game where you talk about the police picking you up and driving him, and you're going...
So that's like one of just a million things. Mm. I was really paranoid about losing any of it, and just kind of these things being gone for whatever reason. So I wrote a thing down, and a lot of the stuff I'd written down was the stuff that I didn't do, and I was worried about, and I kind of, you know, mm-hmm. like, straight away. So then that became... I was speaking to a few people about it, and that almost became... There was one person in particular, I'm not going to name because I promised I wouldn't at the time. She suggested doing it like this, and I went, okay, I'm going to try. So I wrote it in Twine, and the idea is, you go through this experience, and there is a pathway through the game that reflects
exactly
my experience.
What happened.
Nobody apart from me will ever know all of the decisions that I made. Yeah. And then everything else didn't happen, but was... could have happened, you know, mm-hmm. and that's, to me, is the power of sort of interactive fiction. And
well, that was the weird thing, because it says before we start that this is that and the what ifs.
Yep.
And like, as I played through it, because I played through it a while ago, mm-hmm. and I played through it again yesterday. It wasn't a good day yesterday, by the way, entirely because of you, because I played all three. I don't know if you can still see it, but there's this little water stain.
Oh, man, did I make you cry? Oh, sorry,
that's
man.
Tears there. But that one there is actual snot.
Oh, wow. Achievement unlocked.
It was like proper racket. But, you know, that's like one of those things. So
yeah.
I'm an emotional person. I'm allowed to,
well, it's
allowed
same.
To do
it. I think I'm quite in touch with my emotions. And I kind of, but I feel like I'm better in writing. Pen writing. So,
but like, I made different choices this time, mm-hmm. and I was like, I wonder what's true. I should ask, and then it's like, why? Mm. Why do I need to know?
I've had a lot of people actually say, "Did you do this?"
Yeah,
and
like,
and I just it's
yeah,
just
that
not
bit
kind
when
of
stabbed the guy. That's
yeah, the musical number at the end was a bit weird. It was very on brand. So, but yeah, I mean, I can't, to be honest, I
well, you
even
say that I did see some footage of the funeral with the coffin.
Oh god, yeah.
Oh my god. Fucking,
like, just yeah, so just every bit of that was just ridiculous. But
so for those, I'm not going to get you googling coffins. It's a Coronation Street coffin, essentially.
He had his fucking cat on the back as well, like just a big, this big bloody thing. So I was carrying it with this massive cat's face next to me. But yeah, so, I mean, like, it was just a way of capturing this thing that was unique to me, and I've not been back and played it. So I finished it, and mm-hmm. I drew a line under it and went, I've done this, and I went, done, and I've not touched it since. intentionally. But I think it blindsided a few people in the sense that one of the questions I get, mostly from people who are not maybe familiar with the idea of, you know, serious video games that aren't about shooting lasers.
Yeah.
Would be like, why on earth would you make video games about this? It's horrible. Mm. And it's kind of actually, it's not, it's valuable. It was valuable to me as a creator.
Mm.
It's been valuable to other people. You know, I've had comments and emails and things from people saying, I went through something similar and you've captured something that I couldn't get out.
I always find that this sort of that it's weird, this idea that you can... The couple that made the game, That Dragon Cancer, mm-hmm. about, mm. you know, and how people will happily, like tens of millions of people will happily buy a game that is murdering people,
mm.
but then if someone makes a game about someone's death,
yeah.
oh, how dare yeah. you?
There's a disconnect,
what
I think,
fuck?
In, you know, there's no... It's a completely understandable thing that people would write a novel about an experience, or there would be a film about an experience. But then, I don't think it's uniformly true. But I think in wider terms, in a wider audience terms, who are not familiar with this stuff, there's a bit of a void at the moment in terms of people not understanding that games is an excellent medium for exploring this stuff. And
yeah.
there's a uniqueness to games that you don't get from more linear sort of media.
And Sorry to Bother You is a really good example of that.
Yeah,
Sorry
I'm
to Bother You
really
is
happy
one
with that one.
That is what triggered it, like yesterday,
yeah.
the first one.
Yeah, yeah.
But basically, you can read on a news article saying you had, 4,000, however many thousands mm. of messages in those days.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we can't understand that. Like, that's a number.
Yeah, it's an abstract thing until you try
yeah.
it.
And then, like a minute in to Sorry mm. to Bother You, basically, to describe the game, it's like Tinder for a friend or foe.
Yeah, so it's like an unwinnable puzzle game, basically,
yeah.
where you play as myself holding my phone and messages start to stream in of condolence. And your task as a player is to filter out the ones that are actually very thinly veiled journalist requests. Of which I had hundreds as well,
yeah.
and right from minute one, like long before we'd even found out. And the kicker, obviously, with the game is that every single thing that you read is verbatim from the messages. You know, it's only a tiny percentage of the messages I receive.
Yeah,
and it becomes unwinnable, and it's it happens very, very quickly. You know, within a couple of minutes, you can't
yeah.
win.
Yeah, you can yeah. be 30 messages deep, and
yeah, yeah. But if you pick the wrong thing, and you either hit like or hit trash, and
yeah.
it's quite a simple mechanic. But I mean, your point about sort of showing someone, right? You know, that classic thing of show someone, don't tell them. I can get that across to you so much quicker in 30 seconds of gameplay than
like
I could in describing it.
The unwinnable, the unsurmountable nature of it, it happens so quickly and you don't realise.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And like I say, that's 30 messages in and...
Yeah.
Like that's probably,
yeah.
if it had a score, I don't know. Maybe you put a secret
no,
score in the back.
No, so I didn't even put a score. I was going to. So interestingly, it's since been used again. So it's currently not public, but by the time this goes out, it will be. So
okay.
like tomorrow onwards. So Hacked Off, which is the charity set up by Hugh Grant after
yeah,
the hacking
yeah.
inquiry, have licensed.
Are you happy to talk about this?
Yes. By the time it goes out,
yeah, this will go out next Tuesday
yeah,
or the
it'll
Tuesday
be
after.
Public knowledge by then. So they've licensed a version of the game. So I've
okay.
made them like a cut of it that it takes away the personal stuff from me, but it puts you in the position of a person,
mm-hmm.
and they're using it to basically talk about this issue to their audience, which are not games audiences whatsoever.
Yeah.
So they just said this depicts this thing so well, so quickly. You know, so it was a very, very simple game. It took me a couple of days to make. I hired a friend of mine to do the illustration and the sound. It was a weekend project. It wasn't a big...
For them, have you got rid of the tattoos?
Yes. So I got rid of the tattoos and made the more generic hands.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it was interesting that they, as an entity, saw the value in storytelling through a simplistic game. And that, for me, was a really good endorsement of the medium, almost, to say
yeah.
the people we're talking to, most of them aren't video games players,
you
but we can send
that,
this to them.
But you feel that pressure. You can't keep up. And although that's like an unnatural feeling, games aren't designed trying to make you uncomfortable.
Mm.
They have the power to do that. And they have the power to actually put you in your space.
Yeah.
And obviously it's from your perspective. And,
yeah. Yeah.
But the weird thing is, because I got angry... when the second I don't know how many they sent you, but the second version of the Lorraine Show message came in.
There were quite a few of those, yeah.
And I was like, I literally, there was a moment, you cunt. Like, genuinely. And then I was just, I was like angry, yeah. And then yeah. I was like, fucking people. And it's like,
well, this is it. It's just, a lot of it is just disbelief. You're like, almost to the point of laughing. I mean, the name of the game was taken from a piece of paper that got shoved under the door. From a Telegraph journalist who I've not met since, and I'm a complete pacifist, but
you carry a
I
knife.
I definitely could have hit that guy in the face.
And yeah.
This was hours before we'd found out. It was the morning after the attack. Mm-hmm. We'd had no idea what was going on. He'd found my address.
You talk about this specifically in See You Later.
So it's mentioned in that. Then that one act kind of named the game, Sorry to Bother You, and he basically left his business card and a handwritten note saying, sorry to bother you at this difficult time, we'd like to have a chat with you.
But it wasn't even to anyone, it was to the family.
The family of Martin Hett, yeah.
Oh, it did say
to Martin Hett,
They went to the effort of finding out your address, but can be fucked to find
and
out
it says, your name. It says on the note, it'll stick around for a little while in case we want. And it was just, the whole thing was just incredible to receive.
Yeah.
It almost, and my biggest regret is I didn't keep the note. I threw it in the bin because at the time I just went fine. Yeah. And it only weeks and months later, it only really hit me how bad that was. And it was just unbelievable.
Because, like you say,
it's just so invasive, isn't it? And that's the thing.
The morning after the explosion, before
we had no idea he died or anything like that. It was just we were in frantic panic mode. We were all over the place. So it was that level of intrusion. It was just
so
astonishing.
My reaction, I don't know if it tells you anything about me as a human, is because you can sit back down or you can go outside as such. I was outside. I was straight down the street.
I in hindsight, I just, oh man. I mean, obviously at the time everything's sort of high pressure, but I just think I there's very few people in the world I think I could punch in the face.
Genuinely.
But I mean, like, it wasn't just me. And in the horror story that I get all the time, that I think about a lot, is that there was an inquiry about a lot of this stuff, mm-hmm. of which I kind of helped kind of just say, this is what happened. And there was one around, there was one of the major hospitals in Manchester that had hundreds of people come in. They were given...
Was it 22 people died in the end?
Altogether.
Yeah.
So it was a really busy hospital with hundreds of injuries and everything. And these people were working so fucking hard, like, I can't even imagine being a medical professional of any kind in that kind of circumstance. And one of the reporters had sent in a tin of biscuits. This is completely true, you can look it up. Sent a tin of biscuits in, and in the biscuit tin there was a letter asking for interviews. So to see if they could, like...
Which biscuits, though? But I think that's important.
They'd have to be pretty goddamn good biscuits.
We're talking hobnobs.
I'd want, like, a full cake before I responded to an interview request via confectionery.
The tin of the Foxes ones that are all covered in chocolate.
Yeah. Is that the note is just under the good ones with a really thick
chocolate. And with money. And with, like, stacks of money.
But, yeah, I mean, like, that as a thing, as a concept, that someone would go, this is how I'm going to get my interview. Because I'm a realist, and I completely understand there is a story to tell, there is interest and whatever. And I've worked with the press. You know, I went into The Guardian a week later to sort of denounce a lot of the rhetoric, a lot of the far-right rhetoric that's kind of fired up. So I understand the need for the press and the usefulness of the press, but it was just that kind of, that intrusiveness was just horrendous, and it's something I'd never considered until I was in that position. And that was kind of the impetus for making the game, was to say, actually, this is A, something that I want to kind of express, but B, something that I think... If even one person plays this and goes, you know, one journalist plays this and goes, wow, this is unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
And it did. And I've had a couple of people reach out who initially contacted me at the time and said, this was too much. I'm sorry. And that was kind of, that felt a bit weird, actually.
like you're being fair handed to the press, having that understanding. This people want to know.
Well, this is it. I want to turn my telly on and find out what happened. And that's fine.
I do think we as humans want to know now when it's not like I found out about the explosion while I was streaming on Twitch. Mm-hmm. Someone came into chat, actually an arsehole who had built a bot with a like haha
But Jesus, wow.
Suggesting that Ariana Grande was dead as well. So it was a bit of a, what? Some quick Google, okay, there's been that. But then I'm back to doing my day job of playing video games.
Yeah, you, I mean, you kind of, you don't, it's hard to tell the magnitude, isn't it? I mean, I went to bed. I didn't. Yeah. I just went, it's probably nothing.
Yeah.
Good night.
Because people just fucking say any old shit until we actually have any information.
Well, that's what I said. So I wrote a tweet literally before going to bed that just said, there's been some reports of an accident or something. You don't know what's going on. Mm. And it literally said, shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
And then I went to sleep. And that was the last thing I did. And then obviously I woke up the next day and found out.
But like, the general populace don't need to know. We don't need to know the nitty gritty immediately. Mm-hmm. We need to know, okay, this has happened. This is why this has happened.
We don't need a profile of the families involved, right?
Like, it's our hunger for it as much as the media's willingness to put it there. Like, if we as the people and the press agreed, look, next time, hopefully there's never a next time, but next time, can we all just wait a week?
Yeah, or just the headline
give
is fine.
Give these people fucking 5 minutes to breathe.
But that doesn't happen, though. I think that, and it's another one of these things that I think I blame the internet for a lot. That directness and that nowness isn't the thing that we've always had, really. And I think, like, particularly on social as well, like social media, for all the good it's done, there's now a sort of a need for the heartbeat of something that's happening right this second.
My issue with it as well is that it's the unfiltered nature of it. Mm. So you can, misinformation can be the only information you receive.
Yeah.
Because you curate your experience. So if you choose, okay, I'm going to follow Paul Joseph Watson and Sagan of Akkad and whatever puppet account Tommy's using these days, and I'm going to get a version of the truth that isn't the truth.
Yeah, but I think it's different if you're the kind of person who's got the enough critical thinking ability to go, this is not an accurate picture of things.
Mm.
Then it's fine. But the problem is that a lot of people don't have that, and I think some of it is a generational thing, maybe. My stepdad's dad, who I know very well, he is on the internet now. He's long since retired, and he has no inbuilt way of deciphering what is bullshit news. You know, he has no way of looking at two news stories. One of them is from BBC.co.uk, and one of them is from supercoolnews.biz. And he, like any, like I would go, that is obviously nonsense. And it's like there's a whole kind of system at play there of the sort of news and opinion and everything else. Unless you're equipped with the skills to start picking through it a little bit.
Yeah,
and I think this is one of the reasons we're in such a predicament at the moment.
I definitely think education and getting people to at least question, at least look for multiple sources, just even if that becomes a habit. But we also have the problem that you come up against people who are being disingenuous because it's financially beneficial for them to do so. Tommy Robinson's, Katie Hopkins, and like we freedom of speech is an issue that we should all be fighting for, but it's really hard to fight for freedom of speech when people are deliberately misusing it for their own benefit. I genuinely would like Tommy Robinson more if he was just a good old-fashioned racist. But he's not. He's a good old-fashioned racist who's doing it for the fucking money.
He lives in a million-quid gated mansion. It is annoying. And it becomes one of the sort of core... I've courted a lot of... I catch a lot of heat from the far right.
Well, this is... obviously, after...
I do a lot of work in this sector now with baiting racists. It's my new
but obviously, after Martin's death, and you spoke out against the manipulation of what went on.
Yeah, even before the manipulation, it's more a case of there was an instant framing of an us versus them, and it instantly felt horrendous that someone would use what had happened to then suddenly demonize millions of people. And it's just such an easy, obvious thing. And when you've got people like Tommy Robinson and that whole fucking crowd who'll say, "Oh, we're not racists, we're against extremism," but then actually what they profess all day is really hardcore anti-Muslim rhetoric against all Muslims.
But the weird thing is, because they'll obviously talk about people being radicalised while they are attempting to radicalise people themselves.
Exactly. And the radicalisation kind of system is exactly the same, whether it's an Islamist being radicalised or a disaffected young man who joins the EDL. The process is the same. And what gets me even more is that these two sides of the spectrum aren't just similar, but they literally need each other. They need each other to exist. And that's what blows my mind, is just that there's no way of de-escalating this, because you both use the same tactics, the same things. And the thing is, like, if you look at, say, Tommy Robinson badly reading the Quran, it's the same as ISIS using readings of the Quran that are not correct.
Yeah.
And both of those readings are, the Quran is calling for violence. Both of those groups are being disingenuous, and they're both doing the same thing. So then this is almost turning into another podcast entirely now. But
it's fine.
As a thing,
they're used to it by now.
It's such a...
They're used to meeting.
It's very... I find it very frustrating. And I mean, at risk of trying to promote the thing that I'm doing now, I'm working on a game that touches on a lot of this stuff in more detail, which is why I'm getting better at talking about it. Because obviously, for obvious reasons, I've gotten more clued up about a lot of this stuff. So I'm working on a game now that is way bigger and literally exists to explore some of this stuff, because I've been at the centre of something that's much bigger than me now.
It's an important thing to challenge. It's and not just the, like, the most extreme parts of it. This us and them thing that's going on, the othering of not... It's not just about a race or a religion. You see it with...
I mean, that's where it's difficult, though, because, like, as with all things, not just in terms of extremism, but everybody thinks they're the hero in their own story, right? Mm. Everyone thinks they're right, and I get that to a point, but that's what makes it so difficult. You know, I have no doubt that Tommy Robinson is absolutely convinced he's correct about this stuff, and he doesn't see he's the bad guy, despite the fact he's universally despised by people who aren't completely on board with him. And it's kind of that kind of thing to me is extremely interesting as someone who is now part of this sort of story. And the idea that you're in the middle of this thing that is billed as a very polarised thing, but actually, as you say, there's extremes. You know, Tommy Robinson is the extreme of this thing. But I think actually the bigger problem we've got at a societal level is the less extreme part of things, where you've got this normalisation. You know, the Daily Mail is just constantly churning through this stuff.
Yeah.
Where
yeah.
it's kind of, and it's all, it's like a socially acceptable not okayness, where you'll say, "Well, I'm not racist. I just don't want them on my street." Or, you know, all that shit that's existed since the 70s. You know, it's that kind of thing is coming back.
Weirdly, the episode before this, Philosophy Tube one, he has a whole thing about transphobia, and that it's your dad, he calls it. It's like it's what your dad would have said, that they've come around to the idea that, like, say two men might kiss, but I don't want to see it.
Yeah,
you know, it's that thing of like, well, that's still not a good thing. Mm. Okay, you're not going to go punching them, and you're not going to go stopping them. Mm. That's great. Well done. Well done, Dad. But at the same time, it's still not... You're not there yet. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. I think the reason I actually brought up your brother and the games about it is that the creative need to channel that somewhere is really fascinating to me. Because my experience of life and death... I go completely the other way. Mm. And I don't know why that is, but like my cousin Stephen killed himself a couple of years ago. It was fucking horrific. And I just stopped for weeks. Mm. You know, I didn't stream. I didn't create. I was just like, fuck it. Mm. What's the fucking point? And it took so long to even want to put something in a world. I know it wasn't the world that took my cousin Stephen away. Mm. He actually took himself away.
It feels like it, though, because there's so much more to someone's process than that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, like, genuinely, was it... Did this have to exist for you? Mm. Was this something...
Yeah. I think everyone's different, right? And so my stepbrother said he played a little bit and just couldn't understand it. but he was kind of positive that I'd done it. Mm. And I kind of, I think I've always needed to express stuff. And I'm one of the lucky ones, right? I've never been through that kind of trauma. I've, largely had a pretty uneventful life. I've not even lost very close relatives, if I'm grandparents. Never been through anything like that before. So at no point have I had this kind of burning need to get something out of my head and down. Mm. And then this happened, and it felt like a natural thing to do. And the question of it being a video game or something else is, well, if I was not a guy who makes games and I was a poet, then I think my poetry would have taken a new tone and a new whatever. And I, like, ultimately, I'm not that, and I'm this, and that's it. So my ship steered a little bit, well, a lot.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I can completely understand, if I wasn't a creative and I was doing other stuff, then would that story be different?
Mm.
Arguably, yeah. I think it was just you respond to stuff as you are, I guess. You know, my dad, for example, stoic northern bloke, would never. He's a lot more. He's like the opposite of me in that sort of sense. He just has taken it and dealt with it, and he's still in a healthy way, but like he wouldn't talk about it constantly or whatever.
Yeah, he did.
And people do different things. Need different things.
Put it in whatever box it needs to go in, and
It's impossible to figure out how you're going to deal with something like this until it happens. And how I dealt with it was not how I expect. If you'd have said, "Oh, you're going to go through something horrible in a few years," if something happened, what would you do? Would you disappear or whatever? And I kind of like, well, I've seen films about it, and people go crazy and scream at the sky and all this. And the truth is, you have no idea. And what I ended up doing was I poured myself into doing stuff. You know, and before I even started on my own stuff, I was working on a project that had started before it all happened. It was for Naho Matsuda, this amazing artist. I was on a
is this program Everything
with.
Every Time?
Yes, yeah. And it was about...
Look at that research!
Tip-top.
Oh, sorry, we're talking about death.
This project was about putting poetry onto these signs all over the city.
It's like taking information from the city and
within a few weeks, I'd gone back to the project. You know, people were still, we'd not had the funeral or anything yet, and I'd gone back to it. But people were like, "Are you really going to go back to it?" I think I'd gone back to it. It's been about 4 weeks or something, and I went back to work. But it wasn't work, because what I was doing was I was working on something for someone really good, putting something nice back into Manchester, which sounds really twee. But there was part of it was about wanting to do something productive, and part of it was about just doing something and not milling around the house and kind of.
Yeah.
I just never really moped. In hindsight, I should have done. I should have taken a bit more time off. He would have wanted me to. But again, I know
love
that.
A good mope. I've had some great mopes in my time.
Should have had a bloody good wallow, and I didn't.
Good wallow.
But yeah, I mean, it just. I think I've always been a doer, and I just. I think there's a certain catharsis in getting stuff out for me. And yeah, the word catharsis comes up all the time when people ask me about the games. Say, was it cathartic doing all this?
Yeah.
And yeah, like undoubtedly, just in the same way that writing stuff down or shouting or whatever your flavour is, I guess. I just didn't expect it to be this kind of thing, but I'm glad it is.
It's weird when we talk about catharsis, because this whole podcast is catharsis for me. Like, I've suffered from mental health issues since my teens, and creativity was an outlet for that, but then having success and then coming to the end of the career thing, like the creativity then got wrapped into the depression, and it was like there was a couple of years there that were like, this is shit. And weirdly, like being able to talk to other creators, and every fucking creator has got the same 10 problems. It's awesome. like Mike Bithell has got the same problems as Cyriac Harris Cyriac, and it's like there is that being able to share something is just wonderful, but also being able to ask yourself the question of why do I do this? You know, if this makes me feel pain at times, why do I do it? And if you hear an answer back from wherever that is in your brain that you like, then you carry on doing it, no matter what pain you've gone through, no matter what you've been through, which I find fascinating. There's one thing that you talk about in talks that is reflected in the way people remembered Martin. So the hashtag Be More Martin. And you talk about in talks saying yes.
Mm-hmm.
It's just fascinating to me that like you said yes, you lied to get jobs. Yeah.
This is true.
So Google Dan Hare talks or whatever, and you'll hear this story. But you've said yes to things in your life. And it seemed like Martin said yes too.
Yeah, it's not just saying yes. I think it's taking a punt on stuff.
Mm.
You know, like sort of this Hail Mary, what if kind of thing is. You know, we could not have been more different as people.
This is where I'm going. Yeah, you are so like different
as humans, as people in terms of what we were into and the way we were.
Yeah, he's Coronation Street, you're EastEnders.
I'm more of a Slayer guy. Was, you know. But yeah, I mean, but then at the same time, I think that one of the things that I've been told a lot, particularly from like his friends and you know people that I really wasn't in contact with, that they've said that my outlook is quite similar to him, but it's just expressed in a different way.
Yeah,
almost. And like one of my biggest regrets is kind of not realizing that until long afterwards. I mean, the friggin' hashtag in and of itself is stupid. You know, the idea. So my dad said he'd write me out of the will if I ever got a tattoo. I'm covered now. And then he ended up getting hashtag Be More Martin tattooed, and I cannot even believe. And he was such a pussy about it as well. And he doesn't know what hashtag is, but he's got one tattooed on him now. But I mean, that thing is an ethos that came out of this thing just spontaneously. It was amazing.
But it's an ethos that you both clearly already had before.
Yeah, it completely is. And I kind of it turns out we were more similar than we realized. But it's just until he'd gone, we didn't realize until So we were more similar than I thought.
Yeah.
But I never got it tattooed anyway. It's the one other thing. I do have an M. Quietly hidden within a tattoo, which is enough for me, which he'd be howling at. And to be honest, I was going to get For Fuck's Sake Martin somewhere, which I still might, to be honest, because that is much more kind of much more indicative of the kind of interactions that I would have with him.
Yeah.
Just be like, he'd just get up to some nonsense, and me and my parents and a few others would just, there was always just, oh, for Christ's sake, what are you doing? Like, but that feels like a more representative thing. And it goes back to the humour thing, right? Just the idea that you can still, you know, people go, oh, you shouldn't talk ill of the dead. And it's like,
I don't know, man.
A bit, man.
Like, I'm fine with it. Actually, when I was like, you can punch me after I say this, but when I was fucked yesterday, I watched Wendy Williams, this American talk show host. I'm like digging through clips and stuff. This is how I research. It's like three days. I get into lots of stuff.
Getting under the skin. Yeah.
I saw that Wendy Williams clip, and it's like a minute, and I see fucking bald. I was bawling, and then I like just muttered to myself. It's like, if you'd had better taste in music, you wouldn't be dead.
So, well, someone made that joke, and it was like, it was unbelievable. And I kind of, but it's that kind of thing. It's black fucking humor.
But like, it didn't come from the front bit of my brain. That was like this reactive thing that came out of me. And I instinctively looked around my living room. I live alone. No one heard me. You know?
But you know it.
But I know it. And then it was like,
all right. Yeah, no, I'm a big proponent. I honestly do think you can joke about most things in the context of it being, well, how would we describe it? It's appropriately inappropriate.
Yeah, because you can joke about...
If the tables were turned, he would be doing way worse.
Yeah. The only, like, for me, with boundaries and humour is as long as you're not punching down.
Yeah, I mean, that's the kicker, isn't it? You know, and I think that, we even as from when we were kids up until right at the end, we were just dicks to each other, but it was mutual, and that's different too. Punching down is a really good way of explaining it. I think it's if you're doing it, it's not at the expense of somebody, and it's from a good place, you know. And I'm happy to continue to do so. So,
well, like I think I there was a lot more about creativity I was going to ask you about, but other stuff, creativity and dead brothers aside, I really need to piss. So right. I think
on that bombshell,
let's call it a day there. Hey, that was Dan Hare and I talking a lot for 70-odd minutes. We actually talked to them. We actually talked for a fair amount longer, but there were a couple of occasions where I went off on rambles, which ended up in the cul-de-sac of absolutely no point to the rambles. So just for the interest of brevity and making it a more interesting listen, I may have lifted one or two of those out. As you can tell, I'm not good at brevity. That said, there's no change of meaning, or there's no dodgy editing there. And if anyone wants to fight me over it, I can just give you the original audio, and you can go, that the way you did it was way better. I'm only saying this because I don't really edit them particularly much at all. It's just lifting out the 1,000 times that I say like in a day. Otherwise, they'd be like 9-hour-long podcasts. But yeah, definitely check out Dan's work. It's really interesting, and I'm quite jealous of his talent. But that could be said for every single person we've had on the podcast so far. And don't forget, if you want to check out the music from each episode, it'll all be up on danlasak.bandcamp.com. And check out the Patreon as well if you want to throw a little support my way. It would be greatly appreciated. Next week's guest, I can't tell you who it is yet. I can't even give you clues because I haven't recorded it yet. I'm hoping to get it done in the next couple of days. Just, you know, trying to nail down creatives to give me 2 hours of their time isn't the easiest thing in the world. But it's going to be amazing, whoever it turns out to be. It's going to be the greatest podcast of all time, knowing my luck. But yeah, enjoy, spread the good word on my behalf, and I'll talk to you next week.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.